All right, so let's start. Last time we left off, we were talking about mixture models, and specifically the last thing I did in the lecture, I walked through an example of fitting a mixture of two Gaussians to 1D data. So let's buzz through that, and then we'll continue on to higher dimensions and to hierarchical models. The basic idea in mixture models. So I got a few questions after the lecture, and one thing that seems to be not obvious. So you're not trying to classify anything here. There are no classes that you are trying to fit, right? There could be underlying classes, but you don't know them. All you have are observations. You have data points that come from somewhere. And what you're trying to do with a mixture model is to discover what the source of the data is. What is the distribution that describes the data? You're not trying to classify them, even though it looks like you're sort of classifying them into two colors, right? So if you got, again, if you look at this example, if you you have points on a line, and these points don't have any color, right? So they're just points that came from somewhere, and by looking at this, I suspect that they came from two Gaussians. Now, why do I suspect that? I really have no particular reason for doing that, right? I arbitrarily pick K, and I arbitrarily say Gaussian, right? Now, if I assume that these points come from two Gaussians, then EM allows me to fit two Gaussians to the data. There is nothing inherently true about two or Gaussians here, right? So there could be three Gaussians. There could be just one of them. I'm just saying, suppose there is two. Can we find out what they are, right? So that's the idea of mixture models. You have some data. You don't. You assume that it came from a few different sources, but you don't know what the sources are, and you're trying to rediscover these sources. They're not the same thing as classes, not necessarily, right? And we talked about the way of doing that, right? So we start by setting these Gaussians at random points in the space that could be anywhere, and then you iterate through the following things. So given that I've set the two Gaussians, I can now, for these fixed values of the Gaussians, I can now assign partial colors or probabilities to each point. So those colors are based on the posterior probability of the point belonging to the blue Gaussian or to the yellow Gaussian. Basically, does it look more like it came from the blue or from the yellow? And that's what the colors reflect. So for the points that are all the way on the right, they are they're far away from both of them, but they're certainly much further away from the yellow than they are from the blue, if you remember the way Gaussian works. So the Gaussian drops off quite rapidly in the tails. So those are almost certainly, those would almost certainly be colored blue. And then the other ones are, the ones closer to the left side are colored with a mixture of yellow and blue. And that reflects the fact that you're not really sure if they came from the blue or for the yellow one, right? So you do this, you assign this sort of colors, and then what you do is you recompute the Gaussians based on these colors. So suppose that these were the actual colors, now I know how to fit a Gaussian. So most of the points are blue, so I'm going to have a blue Gaussian that covers most of the points, and then for a couple of points that have a little bit of the yellow component, I'm going to fit a Gaussian to them, and it's going to stay sort of spiky and on the left, so because there's really only one example that looks like it could have possibly come from the yellow one. Right? Now once I have refit the parameters for the Gaussian, I can recompute the posterior probability, so reassign the colors again. Right? And what will happen there is now that the blue Gaussian sort of moved to the right, the yellow Gaussian stayed to the left, the colors are going to shift a little. So the points on the very right end, they're still going to be completely blue, but points in the middle, they will have a little bit of a probability for yellow. So you repeat this procedure iteratively, and over time what's going to happen is these Gaussians are going to drift to the two positions in your space somewhere, and they're going to take on different variances from what you started with. And hopefully what you end up with in the end is two Gaussians that sort of sit on top of the data in the way that you would like them to sit on top of the data, right? But it's you should not ask yourself the question, did I get the colors right? You know, did the Gaussian come to its right colors? There are no right colors. I'm not doing classification. I'm just saying there's a bunch of points. I think they came from the two Gaussians. Can I guess what the Gaussians are? All right, so I think that's enough repeating the same thing. All right, so let's look at what happens in higher dimensions. I did an example in 1D, and in 1D everything is trivial, and the update equations are trivial as well. So now let's see what happens in higher dimensions, and also when you have more than two components. So it works for two components as well. So it's k greater than or equal to two technically. So so here's the situation: is this you have the data in some space. I'm assuming it's high dimensional data. So the picture is 2D, but suppose that it's n-D. And what I'm assuming is that there is a set of Gaussians that somehow model this data. So this data came from some number of Gaussians. So what I'm hoping to do is, if I have two of them, then I'm trying to find what they look like based on the data that I see. So this is perhaps a possibility. Again, there is no colors. I'm just saying that perhaps half the points came from the red Gaussian, which is sort of has the higher mean y value and sort of lower mean x value, and it's sort of tilted and rotated in a certain way. And then another half of the data came from another Gaussian. So this is a general task. The things that you have to find to fit a mixture model is you basically have to find three things. You have to find the priors. So the priors tell you what proportion of the data this particular Gaussian is responsible for, right? So in this case, it looks like the red might be responsible for half the data. But that is something that you can actually discover. You don't have to assume that it's half and half. In the previous example, when I did 1D, I have implicitly assumed that the priors are equal. But you can learn the priors from the data if you don't do silly assignments, like silly starting points, like I did in the last example. So what is the prior? What percentage of the data does this Gaussian capture? So the second question is, what is the mean of the Gaussian? So the mean basically tells you where the center of that source is. So, and what that is a vector of expected values for each one of the attributes, right? So in this case, I only have two attributes. I have the x and the y. So I have two expected values. I sort of have the mean or the expected value for x and the mean or the expected value for y. But you can do it for as many dimensions as you want. And those are just the most typical values that you would expect from the points that come from this source, and you do it for every one of the sources. So you have d dimensions times k sources. That's how many parameters you're estimating here. And then the final thing is you need the covariance matrix. And the covariance matrix tells you how oriented these Gaussians are. So the mean tells you where the center is, right? And the covariance tells you whether they are sort of circular, spherical, or if they're extended along one of the dimensions. So if they're extended, that's the diagonal of the covariance matrix. If the diagonal is all the same, then it's spherical. If some of the elements on the diagonal are larger than others, then it's gonna be elongated along one of the dimensions. And then if you have some elements off the diagonal in the covariance matrix, that means that the Gaussian is rotated somehow. So that's the last bit that I have to discover. And I'm gonna do all of them based on iterative re-estimation in the same way as I did on the last slide, based on your guesses for which source each point came from, right? So if I have this PC given XI, this is my guess for which Gaussian the point XI came from. It's not really a guess, it's a probability. I have it for every source. So for example, this point, it would have a reasonably high probability for this Gaussian and a reasonably high probability for this one, maybe half and half. Right? This point out here would have almost 100% probability for coming from the blue and almost 0% probability for coming from the red. So that's my PC given XI. So once I have those values, those are my colors. They're my partial colors. So now how do I use them to compute the prior? The way you compute the prior is you count how many times you saw that color in the data, right? Except now, instead of clean colors like you had on k-means, you have probabilities. So you just add up the probability of blue over all the data points. So if the colors were discrete, 0 or 1, then this would be just a count of how many times I saw blue or how many times I saw red. But now they're not 0 and 1. They're numbers between 0 and 1, probabilities. So you add them up in the same way that you would add up zeros and ones. And you get something which is similar to a count. And that is going to be your prior. Okay? So that's how you compute what percentage of the data each Gaussian corresponds to. The next thing you can do is you can compute the mean of each Gaussian, and that you do, again, in the same way as you would do with if you knew what the colors were. Right? So if you knew what the colors were, then for each blue colored dot, you would just average the values, right? And that gives you the expected value for x1, expected value for x2, and you set that to be the mean of your Gaussian. The only difference now is my colors are sort of fuzzy. Right. So instead of having blue or red, I have a fraction of blue and a fraction of red for each one of them. And this quantity right there, so that's the probability of C given XI divided by n times this prior. That tells me the fraction of blue or the fraction of red that I have for this point. Right. So I'm computing an average, only now it's weighted average. Points that are more bluish, they will count more towards the mean than points that are more reddish, okay? So that's how you compute the mean. This is what you do for the covariance. Remember, the covariance, it's a matrix, so it's D by D, if you have D attributes in your data, and you're gonna have K of those covariance matrices, one for each source, one for each Gaussian. So for each source C, the covariance matrix, it's a matrix, each cell indexed by attributes J and K is just, again, this part by itself is what you would do if you knew the colors. You would just see how the attributes deviate from the mean and average it over all the points. And now all you're doing is you're again multiplying them all by this weight. And this weight tells you how blue or how yellow. So what percentage of C is in that data point I, right? So it's the same idea reappearing over and over again. You're using it in all the estimates, okay? So it's counting only now, not over explicit colors, over probabilities of colors or probabilities of sources. And how do we get that thing? So that thing we get at the at the other half of EM. That's when we have computed some values for the mean, for the variance, and the priors, then we can go ahead and reassign the colors to the points. So the colors are just based on Bayes' rule, so you see how probable each point is for a given source, multiplied by this prior, and sort of divided by a number that makes them all add up to one. Okay, so that's your probability of color blue or color red, given the point. And of course, we're dealing with Gaussians, so this component, so this is the prior, you get it just from there, that's simple. But this part, you get this just from the Gaussian equation, okay? And this is the Gaussian equation in matrix, using linear algebra notation. If that's confusing, I sort of expanded it out to what it looks like without any sort of vectors, right? So this is the sigma is your covariance matrix, which we computed over there. Mu are the means, which we computed for each Gaussian in the previous steps. Note that you have the inverse of sigma in there, so you compute the covariance matrix, you then have to invert it. And you're just seeing how far how far away the vector is from the mean subject to the covariance matrix. Right. All right. I'm sorry? What is JK? Which equation? Yeah, this one? This one. Okay. So just think about, is there chalk? So sigma is a covariance matrix. I have a bunch of Gaussians, right, in the space. Each one of them has a mean. So mu1, mu2, mu3. Each one of them also has the covariance matrix, which is indexed by sort of j and k. So this entry, it tells you how correlated attribute J is with attribute K under the first, so this would be sigma 1, under the first source, so given the first covariance matrix. That's your, that's this thing. Okay. All right. So we talked about how you do the means, how you do the covariance, how you do the priors. The only thing that we haven't done, the only thing that we've assumed, is that you know how to pick K. And K is the number of Gaussians that you have. So now the question is, how do you do that? How do you pick K? And the question of picking K is really the same as picking K in the K-means. So how many clusters do you expect to have in your data? So if you have some expectation, if you know what your data looks like, or if there's supposed to be some groupings, then you know how to set K. But if you don't, if you just get a data set, how can you discover K? So it's a little bit easier in this case, or it appears to be a little bit easier in this case than it was with K-means, although it's deceptive. So with K-means, you remember what we were minimizing is we were minimizing this average distance from the point to the cluster center. So that's what K-means is trying to do. It's trying to make that as small as possible. But distances are sort of arbitrary, right? They don't have a natural scale. So how do you decide what distance is good and what is not? Here it's a little bit better because you have a probabilistic model. It's actually assigning a probability to the data. And as part of the EM fitting procedure, what it's trying to do is it's trying to make that probability as large as possible. Or if you talk about log likelihood, it's trying to make that log likelihood as big as possible. It's trying to maximize it. So it's trying to set the means and the variance in such a way that they fit the data as best as they can. And that translates into this fitting. What that means is making this likelihood function as large as possible. So that's, by the way, the definition of the likelihood. And this is not for the Gaussian. This is for any type of a mixture model. So this is your prior. What is the what percentage of the data kth component of the mixture accounts for, and this is the probability that your point xi comes from that mixture component. So we just did it with Gaussians, but you can imagine doing it with Bernoulli distributions or multinomials or anything you want. And what you're doing is you're sort of summing up the logs of that over all the training instances x1 through xn, right? So the mixture model is going to try to make that as large as possible. So, perhaps we can, it makes that as large as possible subject to you having said what k is. So if you said that k is equal to 10, it'll maximize that subject to k equals to 10. If you said that k is equal to 2, it'll maximize it subject to k is equal to 2. So how do you pick k? So one thing that seems natural is to try to try lots of different values of k and pick the one that gives you the highest possible likelihood, right? It's a good goal because what it means is highest likelihood means your model fits the data really well. So your model thinks that your data is very probable. That's good. So we like that. That sort of brings sanity to the world. But if you try to do that, of course, the problem, you get a certain bit of a problem. So, you know, you would try it with a single Gaussian and you get some sort of a likelihood. And then you would try it with two Gaussians and you'll get another value for a likelihood. And in most likely, and actually almost guaranteed, this value of the likelihood is going to be higher than for a single Gaussian. And then the more Gaussians you stick in there, the higher the likelihood will go. And in fact, you'll get the highest value when you have, when each data point has its own private little Gaussian sitting on top of it, right? So if for this point there is a Gaussian, there is a source dedicated to just this point, right? And for this point, that has its own separate private little Gaussian. So that's going to give you as high a likelihood as you can possibly get. And of course, that's not very useful, right? So you're asking, I give you a data set and ask you to find out how many populations, how many distributions you have in this data, and you come back to me and say, well, as many as the data points. Each data point is unique and special. It has its own source. So that's not particularly attractive. Another reason why that is not really attractive is, so think about the situation where this is your data. You have put a little special Gaussian onto each data point, and you have a perfect fit to the data, and everything is fine. And then what happens is somebody comes up with a few extra data points. Right? Now, you haven't seen these data points, so you haven't placed a special little private Gaussian into those locations because you don't know where they are, right? Because you don't see them when you fit the model, right? So you fit to your training data, but when you see the new data, when you see new testing data points, you can't account for them. So that's bad. So how can you get around that? One possibility is you split your data into two data sets. So you take a portion of your data as training data, another portion of your data as a validation set, right? And then what you do is you do the following training. So you put the validation set aside, you take your training data, for a particular value of k, you fit the mixture model to the training data, and then see how well it does on the validation set, right? So the validation set is going to have those points that you haven't seen before. So if you have overfit, if you placed a private Gaussian on each one of the data points, presumably it'll do badly. So and then what you do is you just pick the K that worked best for the validation set, and then you use that. So that will hopefully tell you how many components or how many populations you have in your data, how many sources the data came from. So it's a nice idea. It doesn't always work. So one of the strange things that happens is in many data sets, depending on how you fit things, you will still often find that it performs best with a private little Gaussian placed on top of every data point. So, and this partly has to do with what kind of distributions you're fitting in the mixture. So that's beyond that's beyond this course. We're not going to be discussing it. But basically, depending on whether the distributions that you're using, if they're convex or concave, you will get slightly different results. So what I mean by that is, if your distributions are mostly like that, mostly like a hat, then the optimal k is going to be smaller than n, and probably quite small. If your distributions are like that, convex, surprisingly, a lot of the time you end up with the likelihood maximized when k is equal to n. So it's kind of a funny result, but it's not what you want. So what do you do if the validation set doesn't work for you? So another idea for figuring out how many components you have in the data is this old idea. It's called Occam's razor, and the big idea there is, if you have two hypotheses that explain what you are seeing, your observations, then you should go with a simpler one. So if both of them sort of explain it roughly equally well, then you should pick the one that is easier to understand, that is simpler. It's a nice idea, and the way you turn it into sort of specifics is there's two information criteria that are typically used for selecting the number of components. So one is Bayes information criterion, and another one is Akaiki. The basic idea there is to say, I have a couple models, they fit the data to some degree, I want to see which one is simpler. So how do you judge if one model is simpler than the other? One way to do it is to look at the number of parameters, total number of parameters that you have in the model. So think about the Gaussians. Now, if you're in 1D, right, each Gaussian has a mean, that's one number, it has a variance, that's two numbers, and also it has a prior, right? So the prior tells you how much of the data that Gaussian captures. So that's three numbers. That's three numbers for each Gaussian. If I do a mixture with 10 Gaussians, I have to fit 30 parameters, well, 29 really, because the prior is summed to one. But that's 29 parameters. If I do 100 component mixture, I have 99 parameters. So the total number of parameters in the model, you can sort of pretend that they are that they reflect how complex the model is. And then what you do is you combine this complexity, so that's P, you combine it with the likelihood. So the likelihood L, that's from up there, that tells you how well your model explains the data, right? And the model that has a private Gaussian on top of each point, that explains the data really, really well. But that model has lots of parameters, tons of them. And then another model, so a model, if you pick a single Gaussian, that is very simple, that has only three parameters, or for 1D it would have three parameters, or actually two. But it probably doesn't explain the data quite as well. So what you try to do is you try to trade off one for another. And actually these are rather equivalent to each other. So in Akaiki you're minimizing the number of parameters minus the likelihood, which is the same thing as maximizing likelihood minus the number of parameters in the Bayes information criterion. The big difference is in one of them, the P, the number of parameters, is multiplied by a log of the number of data points. So so when N is large, when you have lots of data, that will place heavier and heavier penalty on the complexity of the model, on the number of parameters. So your Bayes information criterion, it will typically pick fewer components and fewer parameters than Akaiki. Okay, so it's important to realize these are typical things that people use. Whether they are any good is heavily dependent on what you're trying to do. So you should not assume that either of them will pick a good number of populations for your data. In fact, they're completely arbitrary, really. What you should do is you should try to figure out if there is some other way you can test the usefulness of the model. Because if you absolutely must pick the number of parameters and you have nothing better, then use one of those. But almost any other measure that's tied to what you're trying to do is going to be better than these. Okay, so let's summarize. This closes the mixture models part. So we went in detail through a 1D example. The basic idea, you got a bunch of points, they came from a couple of sources, and you want to discover what the sources are, or you want to discover a mixture of distributions that fits the data as well as possible. So talked about how to extend it to higher D. You can do it both for numeric data and for discrete data. And in fact, there's lots of work on doing this for discrete data. It's just for discrete data, instead of the Gaussians, you would use multinomials because you have counts of words. So the big idea in the likelihood is you're trying to make the model fit the data and fit it in terms of this likelihood criterion. So sort of have to remember that one. It's in relation to clustering, it's very similar to k-means. The big difference is you're not drawing hard boundaries, right? So if I go back to one of these examples, right? So suppose I fit these two Gaussians to this data. in k-means, I would sort of draw a line and say that everything on one side of the line belongs to one cluster and everything on the other side belongs to another cluster. With Gaussians or with mixture models in general, points can belong to both to some degree.
Why are on the slide? Why is it 2p and 2l?
I don't actually have a good explanation for that. The 2 doesn't matter, right? So you can just get rid of it. It's going to give you the same number k. All right. Oh, okay, so the elephant in the room. So just like k-means, this is sensitive to the starting point. So you remember, you start by setting the parameters randomly, and then you let them drift to the right locations. So depending on where you start, you're going to get different results. So if you want to make the likelihood as high as possible, you would run this many times with different random starting points. So that's the same problem that we had with k-means. How do you decide when you stop it? There is no single point where points will not change colors anymore. So you look for when the likelihood is not changing much. So that's your stopping point. Or for large data sets, you see for how many iterations you can afford to run it, how much computing power you have versus how much data you have. You do need to pick k. So I talked about possible ways for picking k. Keep in mind that you're probably better off picking k in some other way, based on how useful the model is for your data. Okay, all right. So now we're going to switch and talk about hierarchical clustering. So, and this goes at the heart of the question of how do you pick the number of clusters. So with k-means, we have this problem. If I tell you that there's 10 populations, k-means will find it. But how do I know that there's 10? Same problem with mixture models. There is no good way to answer how many populations, how many clusters you have in the data, because it's really a question of granularity. Are you trying to coarsely model the data, or are you trying to look at the fine-grained details? So the analogy that I like to think about it is if you think of waves on the sea, there's different kinds of waves, and you can sort of model them differently. You know, are you looking for big tidal waves that happen twice a day? Is that what you're modeling? Or are you looking for ripples on the water? So it's really a question of what you're after. And hierarchical clustering sort of allows you to get around this question of picking k. So the big idea is instead of picking a fixed number of clusters or discovering how many clusters there are, what you try to do is you try to create a hierarchy of clusters, where at the top level, you will have big clusters, clusters that contain most of your data points. So maybe you have 2 or 3 or 5 big populations in the data. And then each one of those populations is going to be subdivided into smaller populations. And down at the bottom of this hierarchy of this tree, you're going to have little tiny clusters that are really capturing the ripples. So, you know, 3 instances in your data have something in common, and then these 12 instances in your data have something in common, and they're in 2 separate sort of bottom level clusters. So that's the big idea. The idea is to move away from a fixed partition of the data set and to create a tree, a hierarchy of clusters. Typically, the way these are done, there's 2 general strategies, either top-down or bottom-up. A top-down strategy, you start by having all your data in one big cluster, and then you start dividing it into smaller ones, and subdividing. Bottom-up, you start from the lowest level, you assign each data point to its own separate little cluster, singleton, right? And then you start merging the clusters that look similar to each other. So both of them produce hierarchies. They will produce very different hierarchies, though. So I guess the first note, we can take something that we already know, k-means, and we can turn that into a hierarchical approach. So k-means, it produces a flat set of clusters, but nothing says that you cannot do it recursively. So you take your k-means, you use it to split the data into 2 clusters, and then for each one of them, you can run k-means inside, and that will split the data further and split it further and split it further. So if you sort of do it iteratively, this is what you get. So at the first level, you know, this is your data set. Maybe k-means will say that this is one cluster and this is another. And then what you do is you put a hard boundary around one cluster, hard boundary around another cluster, and do k-means iteratively inside. So this cluster will be split in two, this cluster will be split in two, and then you keep going. So this is one of the clusters you'll split that into, this one you'll split that into, and then you just do it iteratively until you've split everything all the way down to singletons. So this does, it does work. It's a fast algorithm, reasonably fast. The main problem with this is the greedy nature of it. Once you have run k-means here and you've split it into two populations, they are separate until the end of time, right? So once I've decided that this is one and this is another, this point and this point will never ever end up in the same cluster again, right? So I put hard boundary, so there's no way to tell that this subgroup is sort of similar to this subgroup. In k-means, once you've split them, you cannot merge them together. So it works, but it does have this disadvantage. If two points are nearby, they're not guaranteed to end up in the same cluster with hierarchical k-means. So to address this issue, you can come up, you can use agglomerative clustering. So the basic idea there is, from the start, by design, you're forcing the clusters to be such that if two points were nearby, they will end up in the same cluster, sort of from the start. And that is enforced weakly throughout the clustering procedure. The way the procedure works is you take your set of data, you break it down, and then you create a separate cluster for each one of the data points, right? So it's a singleton cluster containing just each point separately. And then what you're going to do is you're going to iteratively merge them. So how do you do that? So I have n data points. I start with n singleton clusters. What I'm going to do is I'm going to look at all the possible pairs of clusters, so cluster I and cluster j, and I'm going to compute a distance or a similarity metric between them. So I'm going to see how similar is cluster I to cluster j. I'm going to do it for all the possible pairs. I'm going to find the pair that is most similar to each other, and then I'm going to fuse them into one cluster. Right? So I fuse them into one. I'm going to call it CI plus J, because it's going to contain all the entries from all the instances from I and all the instances from J. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to delete CI from the set of clusters, delete CJ from the set of clusters, and add CIJ. So at each iteration, you start with n singleton clusters, and at each iteration you fuse two of them, you end up with one less. And then you repeat this procedure until you end up with one. And at that point, you have a hierarchy. So that one cluster is the root, the singletons that I started with are the leaves, and the intermediate stages correspond to the various locations in the tree. And we're going to look at an example of the way this works. So this is there's two things that you need to do. You need to define the distance between the clusters. And this is different from the distance between the points. Yes?
Do you use, like,
blackboard
that
she's clean? Next slide. So if you need an explanation after the next slide, I will do it. But. Okay. Well, you should really wait until I do an example. So the thing you need to do is you need to define a distance between the clusters that is different than the distance between instances, and we'll talk about the ways of doing that. I'm not actually going to talk about complexity, but it's much larger than it is for k-means. So the basic complexity for this is somewhere on the order of n cubed, where n is the number of data points. So it's much more expensive. So maybe this will explain what you're looking at. So I have this set of data points, right? These are just points in two-dimensional space, A through whatever. So I start by putting a singleton cluster onto each one of the data points. So each point is in its own little cluster. Okay? Then what I do is I look for the two clusters that are closest to each other. Right? So I'm assuming that I can use Euclidean distance to measure how similar or dissimilar the two clusters are. So if you look at the set of, now each one of these is a cluster, right? It just happens to have a single point inside of them. So that is a cluster that contains D, and that is a cluster that contains B, just labels for instances. So I look at all of this and try to figure out which two clusters are closest to each other. And in this case, it looks like A and B are closest to each other. So what I would do is I would say, put a link between A and B. What that means is I'm taking the A cluster, taking the B cluster, and creating a cluster that contains both A and B, right? So now the A cluster is not in the data set anymore, the B cluster is not in the data set anymore, and the cluster that contains both of them, you add it to the data. So this is A plus B, right? So I started with 14 clusters, now I have 13. Okay, 12 singletons and one containing A and B. So, and then I keep going. So now I take this cluster and compare it to all of those, and also do all the pairs, compare all the pairs of the clusters that are left, okay? So you look for the two closest things, and maybe if you do it, maybe the two closest things will be J and K. So what I'm gonna do is, at the second iteration of the algorithm, I'm gonna merge J and K together. So now I have two clusters that contain more than one entry, and 11 clusters that contain single instances. And then you continue this procedure iteratively, on and on and on. So now I look again for two things that are closest, and maybe the closest things are C and D. So I merge C and D together. And then I look at the things that are closest, and maybe the next one is, maybe the next closest things are D and B. So what I would do now is I take the cluster C and D, that cluster, I take the cluster AB, that cluster, and I merge them together. So now I have this cluster that contains A, B, C, D, this cluster that contains J, K, and also a bunch of clusters that are singletons. They only contain one entry. So, and you keep repeating this procedure on and on and on, right? So at each point, you try to find two clusters that are closest together and merge them into the same cluster, right? And sort of the distance, the height where I'm making this link, that corresponds to how far away the clusters are. So these were really close together, and these are really fairly, well, more far away than they used to be, okay? So you keep repeating this procedure, and at the end, what's going to happen is, because the number of clusters constantly reduces, at the end, I'm gonna come to the point where everything is connected. Well, everything but one. So this one is not connected yet. That connects at the last bit. So this is a tree. This is a hierarchy. It's also called a dendrogram. It describes your data set. So this is the top-level cluster. So your top-level cluster contains all the instances in the data. Beyond it, you have two clusters, one that contains everything except for I, except for L, and then you have a singleton cluster that contains L. Right? And then inside of this cluster, you have a cluster that contains A through F, and then another cluster that contains H through N. So it's a hierarchy, and what you can do is now you can sort of walk up and down this hierarchy and pick the number of clusters you want. So if I want 5 clusters, then I just draw a line in the dendrogram and see what is left beyond this line. So what's left is this cluster A, B, C, D, E, so that's it over there, this large cluster A through N, H through N, that's there, and then I have 1, 2, 3 singletons left over. Okay, yes?
When you're connecting the nodes together,
yes.
Do you compare with the mean?
Next slide. So I love anticipating questions.
Because the definition you gave from the previous slide, it means that you have to compare with the mean, but you are here
yes.
Comparing with the
nodes. As I said, next slide. Okay, so this is the procedure. Is that reasonably clear? Okay. I hope I didn't put everyone to sleep because of single complaints. So how do you measure the distance between the two clusters? There is lots of ways of doing that. So it's not the same thing as the distance between one point and another. There's many ways you can do it. So one way you could do exactly what you said. You could put a centroid in each cluster and then measure distances between centroids. It's not actually one of the ways that's listed in here, but it's one way. So if I have three clusters, what I could do is I could say this is a centroid of this cluster, this is a centroid of this cluster, this is a centroid of this cluster, and then I could look at these distances and see which two are the closest. And in this case, these would be the closest, so I would merge them into one. So this is centroid-based agglomerative clustering. There's four other ways of doing that. So the one that I showed on the previous slide is called single link distance. The idea there is I have two clusters, I would like to measure how close they are to each other. And what I do is I look for the two points in the clusters that are closest together. And I take the distance between the two closest points as the distance between the two clusters. Okay? It's called single link, also called nearest neighbor clusters. Let's actually go through the other ones. So that's hopefully clear. Two clusters, look for two elements that are closest to each other and treat that as the distance between the two clusters. Complete link is sort of the exact opposite of each other. So what you do in complete link is you take the two clusters and you look at two points that are furthest away from each other. And then you use that as the distance measure between the two clusters. So why on earth would you ever do that? The reason you want to do that is single link. It tends to produce these long, stringy things. So if I had one cluster that was sort of like that, and another cluster that was sort of like that, right? So the two nearest neighbors, they can actually be quite close to each other. But the clusters overall, you know, these two points are pretty far away, and you're putting them all in the same cluster. So that's undesirable. If you do complete link, then you would be measuring the distance from here here, and you would say, oh, look, these aren't as close as they seem to be. Okay? So that's the complete link. Average link is you take all the pairwise distances between the points and you average them together. It produces similar results to centroid, not quite, well, actually, it depends on what your distance metric is between the individual points. If it's linear, then it's exactly the same. If it's not linear, then it's not. Linear and the number of elements in each cluster are the same. So the average link is you measure distances between all the points in the two clusters, and the average of those distances is your distance from red to yellow, okay? And the last one, one that tends to be quite stable in a lot of applications is Ward's method. So what you're doing in there is you're comparing what happens before and after you merge things into the cluster. So what that means is before I had two clusters, each one of them had its own centroid. And what I can measure is sort of similar to what k-means does. I can measure how far away the points are from this centroid, how far away the points are from this centroid, right? And then if I merge the two clusters together, how far are the points in the merged cluster, how far